It's always great fun when Erica Janik can stop by and pay us a visit. She is a historian, the author of several books, including one we have had a lot of fun with, Odd Wisconsin. She writes frequently for the Wisconsin Magazine of History and other publications, and she's also a producer for Wisconsin Life segments you enjoy on both networks of Wisconsin Public Radio. So it's great to have her back to talk about a piece that she wrote. And the piece, I'm going to make sure I've got the Giving Them What They Want, The Reinhardts and Quack Medicine in Wisconsin. How did you happen to write about quack medicine?
Well, I actually ran across this. My husband is a doctor, and the Journal of the American Medical Association has a history page in their issue. And they had republished something right after the Reinhardts were finally brought to justice, not to jump ahead of the story. But the American Medical Association basically was so pleased that they had finally caught these guys that they published this article praising Wisconsin for their great work. And I remember my husband forwarded this to me, and because I write about Wisconsin history, and he was like, have you heard about these guys? Do you know who they are? And I was like, I have never heard about the Reinhardt brothers. And so that really, I don't know, I just, that article just stuck in my head, and I'm like, who are these guys? Why was it such a big deal to catch them? And so that kind of led us both down this trail.
Well, it is a fascinating story. I'm amazed. Well, you know, here in this day and age, we can say, oh, why would people even consider something like this? But set the stage of the time period when what we're talking about here.
So the Reinhardts were really operating in Milwaukee. They opened up their business, the Wisconsin Medical Institute, in 1902. And, you know, quacks, if we want to call them that, we can get into that a little bit about what exactly a quack is and who qualifies. But, you know, it's the same as true today. You know, people were really just looking for answers to their problems. And what the Reinhardt brothers were promising was a cure, something that could make people feel better. And so I think, you know, sometimes when we ask ourselves how people in the past could believe these things, if we really think about, you know, some problems that we've had and kind of looking for answers everywhere that we can, and if someone seems to offer something that seems like it could solve our problem, it can be very appealing. But also at the time, you know, our knowledge about the body and how it worked was a little bit more limited. Regulations controlling who was a doctor and who was not a doctor were only just becoming coming into play. So really, almost anyone could
call themselves a doctor.
That's right. Yeah. You know, there wasn't really any definition on what made someone a doctor, what even medicine was. I mean, it's kind of funny to think about now, but people, you know, really, there wasn't a clear idea of what qualified as a healer and who was qualified to actually do that healing. And so because there was a lot of gaps in our knowledge about medicine and science and the body, you know, almost anything seemed possible. And it's also a time, too, if you think about it, you know, the early 20th century, late 19th century, there's a lot of new technology coming onto the scene. Electricity is really big. Anything seems possible with this power that we don't completely understand, but seems to be doing all of these things. I mean, we all of a sudden have lights. We all of a sudden, more people are having plumbing. You know, it really seems like almost anything.
And anything's possible.
Exactly. So, you know, someone making these promises, promising that, you know, they have some kind of device or some kind of pill that could cure you. Well, you never know, because look at all of this wonder that we never could have imagined is all of a sudden here. And so why should I doubt that this works? So that's kind of the world in which they're operating.
And they played on people, they use sex a lot, or sexual, to be perfectly honest. And I think that it had to do with how people of the time viewed sex.
Exactly. Yep. I mean, the Reinhardts were really, so they were operating a business that basically any ailment you came to them with, they claimed you had a sexual dysfunction. Now, they weren't the only ones to be offering some kind of sexual dysfunction pill or remedy. There's a really at that time period, there's a lot of anxiety about sex and the body and pleasure, kind of that Victorian idea. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear people, whether this is true or not is another story, but you know how Victorians had to even cover their piano legs because even that was too risque. You know, so there's a lot of like nervousness about sex. People think that it's a good idea to be a sexual being, but at the same time, they worry that if it got too out of control, what kind of moral degradation this could lead to. And there's also some concerns about, there's a lot of new immigrants coming, and yeah. a lot of white Americans are kind of concerned about this and are worried about what's going to happen to the country. And so they want to make sure that we're having strong, virile children. And so, you know, that the sexual health of the nation is kind of in question and needs some bolstering. And so, you know, people want to, are looking to make sure that, you know, they're at the top of their game.
And, you know, there's probably quite a bit of that still going on today, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, I mean, you know, reading some of the, if you look at some of the literature from the late 19th century and the early 20th century, where, you know, these ads for all kinds of doctors and pills and potions that you could order. I mean, I'm not really sure that you can put it next to a Viagra ad. And, you know, there's people are concerned about these things. And they were just as concerned in the 19th century and early 20th century as they are today.
Talking today with Erica Janik, who is author of a piece that she wrote for Wisconsin Magazine of History. It's a great, a great magazine, I think, by the way. It's the title of her piece is called Giving Them What They Want, The Reinhardts and Quack Medicine in Wisconsin. She's got some great photos and pictures to go along with that story. You may have a question or comment. Are you aware of this chapter in Wisconsin history? Do you think we've learned our lessons about not believing in something too good to be true? Probably not for the most part. Give us a call with your questions and comments at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and you can post a question or a comment right there. And we'd love to hear from you. Well, some of the treatments... Well, let's go back to some of the earlier treatments before we go to before the Reinhardts even, mm-hmm. What were some of the treatments that...
Well, a lot of people were, I mean, the big thing I would say is kind of pills that were sold that people would see advertised in newspapers and magazines, some kind of secret Indian potion that was very popular. There was kind of this fascination with what kind of Native American knowledge there could be about herbal remedies and that some doctor had captured their secrets and managed to put it into pill form. So I think pills were some of the big things as electricity became kind of people were really fascinated with electricity and what it could do. There started to be all kinds of electrical devices, extremely dangerous electrical devices. If you think about, you know, kind of harnessing a force that no one really knew how it worked or understood how to control it. So, you know, you were kind of taking a big risk by putting on they often had vests or belts. There's a great line. It says about an electric belt. This one doctor commented how it may not cure you, but it will give you a good blister because, you know, so there are all kinds of different things that people did to heal themselves. You know, before that, too, there was also all of these movements that sometimes were labeled as quackery, which are kind of the hygiene movements. Mm-hmm. People would go and stay at a water cure and, you know, it was kind of a place where they would do all kinds of treatments, being wrapped in cold blankets, standing in cold showers, being put in soaking tubs. So there's all kinds of things that people are doing and trying to be healed because, you know, as I said, the knowledge about how diseases actually work, no one really knew. The germ theory of disease didn't really come out until the late 19th century. So before then, people had all kinds of theories about what caused disease and what caused sickness. And so when you don't know, like almost anything can seem like a good thing.
Why not give it a shot?
Exactly. Yeah. Even an electric vest or...
Oh, Nelson in Round Lake, Illinois, we go to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yes, I just wanted to comment that I read the article and I thought it was fantastic.
Oh, thank you so much.
Oh, yeah, thanks very much for calling. And what'd you like about it?
I just, for me, it helped me to understand that even though we got some problems with our medical people today, it's so much better than it was then. So it kind of gave me a new perspective.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear that. Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, I think... I actually co-wrote this article with my husband, and, you know, as I mentioned, he is a doctor, and, you know, I think it gave him a more of an appreciation for all the paperwork he has to fill out in his life. You know, there's a lot of paperwork involved in our medical system today, but a lot of it is to really, like, protect us and to help us. And so I think as we were researching this article together and talking a lot about it, you know, I think it made him realize, too, that, you know, some of this stuff is a definite improvement over what was going on in the past.
Yeah, and I think he even says at the end something to the effect that now I don't mind so much the, the fees that I have to pay for licensing and so forth.
Yeah, you know, they really, you know, licensing laws in the U.S. really, they had a hard time putting them in place. And part of it was people just thought that here in the United States, like, licensing laws and kind of seem kind of elitist. And that we should really have this kind of democratic spirit, and that people could use their own common sense to decide what was right for them and what was wrong. And so we had some kind of weak licensing laws for doctors up until the early 19th century, and then most of them disappeared. Most states overturned them, and so that really, like, made it possible for a lot of these various medical movements and quacks to operate, because, you know, it was really... something that people just didn't think was a big concern, that kind of the marketplace would take care of it, that we would figure out who the best people were based on, you know, what worked, those people would get the business. But after a century of, you know, this type of stuff with vests and weird helmets and
the vacuum cap.
Yeah, exactly. You know, things like that, you know, realize that perhaps we should have a little bit more regulations in place, things to keep people safe, and really to make sure that people that were calling themselves doctors actually knew what they were talking about.
Yeah. Oh, that vacuum cap, I don't know. It'll do any good or not. You place it on your head and be sure to have it loosened like the thumb screw on the top of the cap. Oh, my goodness me. And there's a great picture of it. Erica Janik, our guest, she'll be with us right up until 12:30 today to talk about quacks here in Wisconsin. Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Most of us have heard of snake oil salesmen, but what about hawkers pushing treatments like electrical belts and vacuum caps or magnetic saline fountain water? Oh, my goodness me. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. My guest today until 12:30... historian and author Erica Janik, and she's written a great article about quack medicine in Wisconsin, has some great stories to tell. What do you think leads people to believe outlandish claims, and are we any less susceptible today to that same kind of hype? I hope you'll join in by calling us at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. And go to our Facebook page as well, at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you like the page while you're there, you'll get regular updates on upcoming show topics. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this look at the news. The Wisconsin Magazine of History is a great publication. The summer issue for 2011 has a lot of great stories. And my favorite in that edition is written by Erica Janik, who's our guest right now, historian and author. And the title of her piece is Giving Them What They Want, The Reinhardts and Quack Medicine in Wisconsin. So we're talking with her about quackery here in the state when it comes to medicine and as it existed back then, and maybe you get into a little bit about what's going on today in that area. Call in with a question or comment at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And Mary in Augusta is online and waiting, so we're going to go right to Mary. Mary, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. well, my poor parents, I can't think now how naive they must have been. But would you believe that at one time, to cure a headache, Dad had purchased some kind of an electric thing that put out a purple, it looked like a tube and then a disc on the end, and that disc put out a purpley electric shock, and you rub that on your head to cure a headache.
Oh, boy.
That was, now, that's number one. And then number two, there was a ring, a great big plastic ring that you put over your body, and you plugged it in, and that sent a current through your body that was to cure everything from, I think, osteoporosis to tuberculosis. I'm not sure, but it cured everything. And then, as far as medicine goes, when we were children, we took Scott's Emulsion. Look that up in your book. Scott's Emulsion. I think it was cod liver oil and paste. I don't know.
or maybe a little booze in there or something, Mary.
Well, it was fed to children. I don't know. Maybe sugar and paste. Oh, let me think of some of the other ones. Oh.
Well, I tell you what. While you're thinking, you want to comment, Erica?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in some ways I'm just listening thinking, I actually can believe it. I can believe that people purchase things like this because I've seen ads for them and read letters of people that, you know, testified that these things actually worked. You know, the electricity thing I think is particularly interesting. You know, people have been kind of shooting electricity through themselves basically since the 18th century. There used to be electrical shows where kind of itinerant electricians would travel around and electrify people, claiming that this force that, you know, we couldn't see but seemed to have this great power could cure you. And I think, you know, people have been coming up with all kinds of devices involving electricity and in hopes that, you know, it could somehow rearrange the molecular structure of your body and somehow get the disease out of you. So these things continue well into the 20th century. I think some of the reasons you see a lot of these devices in the 20th century is because it was a lot of the drugs that became regulated in the early 20th century. In 1906, the Pure Food and Drug Act really kind of cut down on some of the magical potions that were very popular in the 19th century. But medical devices really didn't have the same rules around them. So that just led to an uptick in people having a helmet with a purple light and putting some kind of ring around you. So the devices just, you know, didn't have the same kinds of regulatory structure surrounding them.
Hmm.
Well, some of the so-called doctors were not above it either.
No, not at all. I mean, unfortunately, I think some of that continues to this day as well. You know, I think a lot of doctors become promoters or, you know, actually do believe that some of these things work because, you know, for them, they've seen it work for someone. Who knows why it worked or what exactly they were seeing. So there definitely are doctors that are promoting this stuff today, just as they were in the past.
Thank you, Mary, very much for calling. Appreciate your call very much. Oh, boy, lots of callers online. Rose in Blanchardville, we'll go to you next. Hi, Rose.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
My story is about my father-in-law, who was trained as a pharmacist. So he knew that the two things that people did not do years and years ago was they didn't wash themselves properly and they didn't eat proper food. So what he did is work out of a suitcase. And he sold a liquid that that helped the people go to the bathroom, and then he also picked up some caps from bottles, and he boiled down Fell's naphtha soap, and he stuck it in these bottle caps, and he went to a Chinatown. And he picked up newspaper, and he put the paper over the top of these bottle caps. So he sold it as some ancient Chinese recipe for sore feet that people would have, what do they call that disease that they have in their feet? And he says it was just rub this on and then put a little bit of water on it and just let it stay overnight. And he says wash it off in the morning. And that's all it needed was to be clean.
Well, that's one that might have worked, I guess.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, definitely. You know, it sounds like your relative had kind of all the tricks of the trade, kind of getting that idea of some, like, place or people that we associate with some kind of mystical qualities. That really helps sell your drug. As I was mentioning earlier, you know, people a lot of talked about Indian remedies, but you know, there's a lot of mysticism associated with Asia too that starts happening. So, you know, when you mentioned going down to Chinatown and you know, there's some ideas that, you know, you're getting this ancient wisdom from various cultures and somehow bottling it for people. But yeah, that one actually, you know, might have worked.
Well, he also worked for Walgreens. And I don't know if you remember, in Walgreens, they used to have at the end of their stands, they used to have a guy standing there selling stuff. And he did. And he would first put a carrot on a fork, and he would hold it over a fire, and that would kind of like attract people, because then they would wonder, what is he doing there? And then he'd just put the carrot down, and he'd talk about his stuff.
Sounds like he was a promoter.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks a lot, Rose. Those are great stories. Appreciate it. Facebook comment from Peggy. The Road to Wellville, one of my favorite movies, deals with the subject of quack medicine, crazy healing gadgets, and sex as a remedy. Are you familiar with The Road to Wellville?
I am, yeah. You know, and it's based on an actual place, you know, in Michigan, the Battle Creek Sanatorium. And it actually kind of started as some of the remedies that they were using there. I think this is where it gets into that squishy definition of what exactly is a quack and what isn't. You know, I think quackery is often the name you give to something else, something that you don't agree with. There's no real definition of what something, when something is a quack and what something is not. So often in the 19th century, you know, a lot of doctors would claim that they were allied with science and that they could prove their things by science. But, you know, science wasn't really up to modern snuff. And they really, you know, it was mostly competing practices and competing ideas of how different things worked. But no one really knew. And so some of the things that they talk about in The Road to Wellville were cures that, you know, a lot of medical systems were promoting, you know, having to do with getting fresh air and exercise. And sure, some of the things that they did there too were some of the things that, you know, we would kind of think of as quackery, the pills and the devices. But I think there's, you know, it kind of illustrates this tension point where it's hard to really tell what's real and what's not.
Yeah. So. And Billy in Madison has something, I think it kind of goes along with that. Billy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Great show and great topic. I wanted to just ask the speaker that, you know, Chinese medicine goes back 4,000 years and acupuncture has now even been recognized by the Mayo Clinic as helping in, you know, the rehab and intensive care units, that, you know, things like these new modern biofeedback systems are based off of those 14 channels that acupuncture runs off of. Do you see that kind of moving from quackery to actually brilliant devices might be a happy medium to help drive costs down within our current system?
Well, I don't know if I feel fully qualified to answer that question, but I think speak to a little bit of what you're saying, the kind of the merging of some of these therapies that were really seen as quackery in the past are now becoming part of mainstream medicine. And, you know, you're seeing the rise of these integrative medical clinics at some major academic medical institutions like the Mayo Clinic, as well as at Harvard and Duke. So there is kind of this coming together of kind of alternative medicine and mainstream medicine, which is really a new thing, because up until really about the 1970s, the fact that these two strains of medicine could be thought of as complementary in any way was pretty much unthinkable. You know, all of these groups were basically working for the extinction of the other. But I do think that there are, you know, there's a lot of alternative therapies that we're not really sure how they work or if they work, but a lot of them are cheaper than a lot of the mainstream medicine things that we use now. You know, I don't want to say, I don't really know what's going to happen in the future, but I do think that there, you know, people do report feeling better by doing some of these things like acupuncture and other therapies that they've been using for thousands of years. So there might be some value in it.
Well, and thanks, Billy, for calling. Appreciate it. And a caller said she would probably be considered a quack since she's a practicing chiropractor, naturopath, and does homeopathy. But she said it's important to remember that not only were the non-medical people doing pretty crazy stuff, So were the real doctors.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, particularly in the 19th century, I think it's interesting the things that she's practicing there. Homeopathy in particular was probably the most formidable challenger to mainstream medicine in the 19th century. They had hospitals, they had medical schools, they had professional organizations, thousands of doctors that had been, you know, trained in traditional medical schools converted to homeopathy. A lot of these groups were appearing in the 19th century, like the other one she mentioned, naturopathy, were appearing because people were really dissatisfied with what the mainstream medicine techniques were, because sure. In the 19th century, it was bleeding, puking, blistering, you know, really uncomfortable things people had been doing for, you know, basically 1,000 years, because there was this idea of imbalance in your body. It was based on Galen's ideas of the four humors. And so the way that people restored balance to their body was by kind of bleeding out a bunch of blood or making you puke. And, you know, a lot of these things were terribly uncomfortable. And people were really dissatisfied with them. And so a lot of these new groups started appearing and gaining adherence. So, you know, she's right that a lot of the things that have happened in the past and the present seem kind of crazy.
Well, Janice emailed to let us know that a website and virtual museum is called the Museum of Questionable Medical Devices, and people can visit it at, it's at museum, this is all one word, museumofquackery.com.
That's right. Yeah, it's a very interesting thing. You can see lots of the advertisements and a lot of the devices. I think the guy who runs the website also has a pretty interesting book that came out a couple years ago called Quack and some subtitle. But it shows lots of some of the devices that people believed had a medicinal value in the past. So it's pretty fascinating to see the various claims that were made, and just to, you know, get an idea of, you know, I think it really, really gives you a good sense of the fact that people in the past are people just like us in a way, you know? We really are just looking for answers. And sometimes those answers in retrospect can seem kind of crazy. But at the time, you know, it was kind of a hopeful vision of the future.
Yeah, maybe 50 years from now, 100 years from now, people will be scratching their heads wondering what we were thinking.
Exactly, yeah. You know, I mean, it's amazing how little time it takes for something to almost seem kind of outdated and silly. But, you know, at various, if you really just try to think about what was going on in that time period and really think, you know, I think technology has changed, context has changed, but a lot of things about our, like, very basic needs and what we're looking for in the world are exactly the same.
You know, we did not get to the definition of where the word quack comes from. And I told our weather guys who were on yesterday after the show, and they were amazed and thankful to know. So tell
us. Well, it's funny. Actually, the word is, the origins are a little bit obscure. There's kind of, I think the main definition that people like to, that think it came from is this Dutch word, quacksalver, which was an itinerant seller of medicine, often a charlatan as well. And that's where they think that the word quack came from. But a lot of other people, perhaps in jest, speculated that it also came from the duck-like squawking of people, you know, selling their medicines. Because it really was people, you know, traveling from town to town, yelling about their potions. And it was like kind of like a traveling circus. So, you know, that kind of squawking to get attention was probably also related to the quack label.
Peter in Land O'Lakes, on to you now. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I remember seeing a veterinary medicine, it was antique, that was also labeled for human medicine or human use, and I wondered if the guest had ever come across anything like that or had any comments about that.
Are you talking about
the fine line between human and animal medicine, you know, especially around the turn of the century?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, you know, necessarily about what you saw in particular, but I do think that you're right. There is this fine line between what works for animals and what works for humans, and I think that's still kind of the case today. You know, a lot of things are tried out on animals and then transferred to people to see whether they work too, and I think people were kind of doing that in the past, perhaps in a less organized and formal way. But, you know, if a guy saw that something made his horse feel better and maybe it would make him feel better, too. So, you know, I think that there can be these cross applications.
And it goes the other way, too, actually. I mean, there are certain types of medicines that we've taken Prozac type things that wind up with our giving to our dogs.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Growing up, my parents would give aspirin to our dogs. And I don't know how my parents knew that they needed aspirin per se, but.
There you go. Peter, thank you. Susan in Bristol, on to you. Hi, Susan.
Hey, everybody. I don't know if you recognize that voice. Good afternoon. But that's the quack doctor, Dr. Nick from The Simpsons. That's the way he would greet everyone.
Oh.
That was good.
Quack dockery goes back in my family for a long ways. My uncle Leon thought he would be able to learn how to fly if he fashioned some wings, and he did. And he jumped off the barn and just landed on his head. And my grandmother and the neighbor lady picked him up. They figured his stomach must have flipped. And one of them picked him up by his arms and the other one by his feet and swirled him around in a circle to get the stomach to flip the other direction.
Oh, man.
Fortunately, he survived.
I'm glad to hear that.
My father also became like the quack doctor of our neighborhood when I was a child. I mean, if somebody got a big sliver stuck under fingernail or toenail or something like that, he would like take a razor blade and he'd get it out, and everybody knew that he was able to do this stuff. And then one day a neighbor, his name is Clarence, and he had been doing something with some steel, a big chunk of steel went into his eye, not a big chunk, a little one. And so he came over to my dad to see if my dad could fix it. My dad was like, let me think about this for a minute. Then he went out into the garage and he brought back a big magnet. And he was starting to pull this magnet out of his eye. Pull the steel out of his eye with the magnet. And he almost had it, but it was kind of going around the wrong way. Like, if you can imagine, put your finger in your mouth and push it against your cheek, it was like going around the wrong way. And finally, his wife, Ruby, said, "That's it, Clarence, we're going to the doctor."
Oh, man. Ooh, you're making us both cringe here. Oh, my goodness. But, you know, Susan has a good point. There were people in every little community that knew and did know something about medical treatment.
Yeah, I was actually thinking the same thing. Just, that really goes back to basically colonial America. You know, we never had enough doctors for how many people that we needed. And so people really came to depend on someone in their community who was known to have some kind of healing knowledge and healing power. And often in colonial times, it was actually the minister, because he was generally considered the most educated person in town. So he probably had like a home medical manual that he would look up remedies and, you know, try to attend to your physical being as well as your spiritual being. And so, you know, there was always like kind of healing people around that had some kind of knowledge. It was often women that did it in the household. And, yeah. And only when you'd exhausted all of your in-house options would you then try to go for a doctor. Because, you know, in some areas of the country, a doctor could be hundreds of miles away. So this was one of the problems, too, with, you know, defining who was a doctor and who was not, is that the United States was incredibly large compared to, you know, all the European countries. And so trying to have enough doctors and getting where everybody was made it, you know, really dependent on any kind of healer you could find.
And that's still a problem today, too, in some parts of the United States. Right here in Wisconsin, there are, you know, places where people have to drive a long way to see a doctor.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it continues to be an issue in that rural areas have struggled to have the medical attention and providers that they need. You know, this is a problem that unfortunately goes back, you know, all the way to the 17th century. I think that technology is helpful in some ways now, in ways that it wasn't before. With telemedicine, people can talk to a doctor, you know, over an internet connection. But, you know, that's still, not everybody has that at home either. So still a problem.
Leonard in Boulder Junction. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling.
Oh, I just have to share my best quack story with you. My brother's a doctor, and we were talking one day, and he said, well, you know, one of the incentives for them to create the Food and Drug Administration and begin to regulate all this was that there was one man who had a remedy for losing weight. And he sold this big pill, and it was very, very, very effective. Everybody who took it started losing weight. What they didn't realize until later was that he had put a tapeworm inside each pill.
Oh!
A person would ingest the tapeworm, and lo and behold, they'd start to lose weight.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, that was really disgusting.
Oh,
really disgusting.
Thank you, regulation. I mean, I don't know if every rule was good, but that was definitely one that wasn't just a quackery. It was, like, pernicious.
Yeah. Oh, man, that is... Well, we've heard a couple of cringers here right toward the end of the show, Erica. Oh, my goodness. And, you know, here we are. We didn't get around to really talking about the Reinhardts, which is, and they're such an interesting story. And you know what? We'll let them read the article for
Perfect.
That.
Perfect. Sounds great. Yep.
Because the Reinhardts operating here in Wisconsin made a lot of money, and they did it in nefarious ways. Let's put it that way.
Yes, definitely.
Erica, it's a great pleasure as always. Thank you so much, and you'll be back.
Yeah, I hope so.
I hope so. Well, you've got a book coming out.
I do have a book coming out, so.
We'll have you. I know we're going to have you on for that. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Erica Janik, historian, author of many books, including Odd Wisconsin, and she writes frequently for the Wisconsin Magazine of History, and the latest in the summer issue of Wisconsin Magazine of History is Giving Them What They Want, the Reinhardts. Go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you'll get a link there. Tomorrow we'll talk about a new documentary on the Lower Wisconsin River. Thanks for listening. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.